Welcome to the Back 9 Report, presented by eDraft.com.
Hello and welcome to this week's edition of the Back 9 Report, presented by eDraft.com. We go live every Tuesday at 8 p.m. Eastern Time and check in on the world of golf to bring you the latest news, insights, analysis, interviews, recaps, previews. Hey, we cover anything and everything golf. My name is Carlos Torres. Every week, I'm alongside my co-host, Fred Alvader. Fred, hi, how are you today?
Hey, Carlos. What a great weekend. The WGC Dell Match Play in Austin Country Club was a big hit. Jason Day moves to number one with just 1 week remaining until the Masters. And Lydia Ko added another trophy to her mantle at the Kia Classic. Looks like she's ready for the season's first major at the ANA Inspiration this week. A lot of golf to talk about, Carlos. Let's go.
Let's go. And we have our VIG. Very important guest of the week is golf designer Mike DeVries, so you don't want to miss that. Hey, Fred. We're going to start right away with the weekend backspin, and you're going to take the first shot. The big tournament on the PGA Tour was, like you mentioned, the WGC Dell Match Play. And Jason Day, oh my goodness, how about the dominant performance by him? He went back to number one. Tell us all about it.
Well, you know, Jordan Spieth was the big show down there because being from Texas, the UT, he didn't graduate, but he's a UT guy. Got knocked out of the match play in the round of 16 by Louis Oosthuizen, which might be a good thing as it will give him a couple more days rest. He's going to play in Houston this week and then head to Augusta next week. Spieth also lost his number one world ranking to Jason Day. The Jason Day and Rory McIlroy semifinal match on Saturday morning was tight all the way right down to the end with Day getting the one-up win. Except for Spieth getting bounced, it was exactly what the tournament and the tour needed to boost the match play going forward. With the win, Day, who reached number one on the WGR twice last season, regains the top spot from Jordan. Although South African Louis Oosthuizen lost in the final to Day, he played very well all week. He appears to be in a very good place heading to Augusta, and he has had some success there before, losing to Bubba a couple years ago in that playoff. This was a very big week for Spain's Rafa Cabrera-Bello. He played poorly versus Oosthuizen in the semifinal match, but moved into the top 50 in the world and earned an invitation to the Masters. To top it all off, he beat a somewhat disinterested Rory McIlroy in the consolation match and picked up a very big check along the way. I just don't think Rory's heart was in that second match on Sunday after his loss to Jason Day in the semifinal earlier in the day. In the last 3 years, Carlos, the match play winner has been Jason Day, Rory McIlroy, and Jason Day again. The cream always seems to rise to the top. But there's a bigger story here probably. You know, it's a longer event. The winners have to play seven rounds in, you know, like 6 days. So, I mean, it's you know, it's a big deal. You know, it's a lot of walking up and down. It's very grueling, mentally challenging. So it takes a younger guy, a fit guy. Hey, Austin Country Club looked great. It makes almost a perfect venue for match play. A lot of risk-reward there. The Pete Dye designed Austin Country Club may have been the biggest winner of the week. It just looked great on TV. Victor Dubuisson helped put the match play back on the map a couple years ago, but with Day and Rory both in the final four this week, may have been the best WG match play ever. Tom Kite in the booth at the tournament was wonderful. He was spot on with his analysis and insights for every shot. True, he has played Austin Country Club hundreds of times, but he was really good in the booth. If he ever decides to quit playing, he might be pretty good up there behind the desk. As I mentioned, the match play involves seven grueling matches over 5 days. It's a physical test. Did you see the hills on that golf course? today's golf is not a game for old men. Physical fitness, which is also a function of mental toughness, is a prerequisite for succeeding in golf today at the highest levels. One last interesting point here from the match play, Carlos. There were 26 Americans in the 64-man field at the outset. But the last Americans, Dustin Johnson, Ryan Moore, Chris Kirk, and Brooks Koepka, were all knocked out in the quarterfinals on Saturday afternoon. The Sunday semifinals, and the finals were an all-international affair, a Spaniard, Irishman, South African, and Australian. And we continue to wonder why the U.S. continues to lose the Ryder Cup, Carlos.
Well, let's say it this way. I mean, they did a good job anyway. They didn't rise to the top. But I think we learn a lot about Brooks Koepka, Patrick Reed. I mean, I think the future is bright. I mean, we lost, yeah, but hey, the future is looking bright. So good thing there. I think, like you mentioned, great play there by Louis Oosthuizen, but Jason Day was just monstrous. Even though it looked like he wasn't going to be able to finish, because at the beginning in the first round he suffered his back injury flared up, and I was saying to myself after the end of the day, how is it going to be possible for him to finish, like you mentioned, seven rounds? Oh my God, he definitely, his back was fine, because to play seven rounds in that course. And win the way that he did. I mean, he's playing incredible, and hey, he is seeing green. I think that right now he's the man to beat. I mean, I had picked Rory McIlroy, but to win in the Masters, but the way Jason's playing, wow, he has to be there. There's a lot of players playing great, and I think next week we're going to point all that out, but the Masters is going to be great. So one last thing that you would like to say before I move on to the other tournament.
No, I just I did enjoy watching some of the match play last week, and I don't usually watch much of it, but I did watch a little bit more this week, and I watched most of the McIlroy Day match. That was really, really good, because it was just, you know, any hole could have changed the match. Day was playing really good, but to your point about his back, you know, modern medicine, he travels with a therapist, I'm sure he's taking muscle relaxers, all that stuff, and he knows how to stretch and all that good stuff. But still, when you got back spasms, you got a problem. And if you noticed through the week, he was walking very upright, very kind of stiff-like he looked like to me, like he was kind of favoring his back a little bit. So I think it was still there. I think it was still bothering him, but he just played through it. And, he never said a word about it. After that first day. So, kudos to him. As for the Augusta, I know we're going to talk about it more, but, man, you got Jason Day, you got Rory, you got Adam Scott, even Jordan's playing pretty good. Just on and on and on and on. Louis Oosthuizen, I mean, my goodness, there's about 20 guys that are at the top of their games coming into this Masters. I am so excited for it. I can't hardly stand it, Carlos.
And we cannot stress enough how big I think it's going to be with all those big players, those big names playing well. And just to one final point, Jason admitted afterwards that he thought about pulling out Thursday when his backside stopped him. So he did thought about it Thursday morning, that about pulling out. So a good thing he didn't. So congratulations to him. What a great win for him. And the WGC, to me, this win, if not the best, one of the best plays that I have ever seen in the history of the tournament. Anyway, there was another tournament as well this past weekend. It's an alternate tournament to the WGC, the old match play. And it's played in Miami, Puerto Rico, where Tony Finau, he earned his first PGA Tour win this weekend by outlasting Steve Marino after three playoff holes. Marino, unfortunately, remains winless on the PGA Tour. So both were going for the first. Marino also lost in a playoff in the 2009 Colonial. Marino had birdie the 18th to tie Finau and got into that playoff when Finau missed a six-foot birdie putt at the 18th. Finau, who is a 26-year-old from Salt Lake City, won with his third straight birdie in the playoff on the par 5 18, blasting out of the bunker to 3 feet. Marino was just off the back of the edge of the green in two, but he left his putt from the fringe 4.5 feet short and missed the birdie try to the right. So, Fino, you know, he's the longest hitter on the tour right now, but he's rather inconsistent with the rest of his game. But when he's able to sharpen those rough edges and be consistent, like he did this past week, by limiting his mistakes, he made only 3 bogeys a week. He hit 72% of his fairways to go along with a 302-yard driving average. Man, he's capable of contending, and it paid off as he earned his first win. You know, he stands 6'4". He's a former Utah high school basketball star, and he's now right now in his second full season on the PGA Tour. If you might not know, he's the cousin of Milwaukee Bucks NBA player Jabari Parker. 54 hole leader Ian Poulter, he closed with a 72, missing an 18-foot birdie putt on the 18th to join the playoffs. He was playing the event for the first time after failing to get into the match play tournament in Texas as the first alternate. He took a one-stroke lead into the final round, but finished in a tie for third with Mexico's Rodolfo Causu Wong, one shot off the playoff pair. Worth mentioning is that, unfortunately, I picked up the wrong year to leave Puerto Rico, because Puerto Rico's own Rafael Campos became the first Puerto Rican to hold a lead in the PGA Tour tournament since Chichi Rodriguez did it in 1979. He held the lead for the first 2 days, but he went even par the whole weekend and couldn't capitalize on it and finished in a tie for eighth, just 3 strokes back along with Will MacKenzie and Aaron Baddeley. Other notable finishes, former champ Scott Brown earned a top 10 finish for the fourth time this season with a T5. Defending champion Alex Cech and Graham Dallet finished T11, and former number one Luke Donald, who also failed to make the WGC match play, finished a silent T28. And Fred, former champ Jordan McNeil, was disqualified following his third round, and a non-conforming club was the culprit for the DQ. He should have left it in the hotel because he should have 5 over on that round.
Yeah, you know, I think this was the third win on the PGA Tour for a big breaker. You know, Tony Finau is a former alum of the big break. Tommy Two Gloves has won on tour, and Matt Every were all big break alumni. So, you know, some of those guys have gone on to achieve some pretty good success after that, after being on the Golf Channel's big break. Hey, Carlos, let's talk a little bit about women's golf. World number one, Lydia Ko, finished at 19 under par and held off a charging world number two, NB Park, during the final round of the Kia Classic to win her first LPGA event of the 2016 season. The four-shot victory was the 11th of Ko's short career. Including her 2 wins as an amateur, 5 of Ko's 11 LPGA Tour wins have come after she held the 54 lead. Ko got off to a very hot start on Sunday with birdies on her first 4 holes. She said, "I saw NB was making a lot of birdies. I knew that I needed to focus until the last moment, and fortunately I made some birdies down the stretch, which really helped." She looked to be running away with it before she called a penalty on herself for a double hit as she was putting on number 10. I didn't actually see that, Carlos, but I understand she was putting off the fringe, and when she hit the putt, the ball hit a depression or something, went like straight up in the air, and hit the putt again on the putter again on the follow through. So, click, penalty stroke. Playing a few groups ahead of Ko, Park cut Ko's lead down to 1 stroke thanks to a 15-foot birdie putt on number 17, but Ko carded birdies at 16, 17, and 18, and the lead was just too much for NB to overcome. Ko now heads to the ANA Inspiration looking for her second career major victory with a great deal of confidence. "I've been playing consistently well, so I'm really happy with that, and it's just good to see the hard work we've put in the off season." The ANA Inspiration will be the season's first major tournament on any tour. Mission Hills tends to reward long hitters, but when Ko is at the top of her game, she can score on any golf course. The winner this week gets $390,000 of the $2.6 million purse. Brittany Lynchcombe is the defending champion, and 46 of the top 50 women in the world are in the field at the A&E Inspiration this week. Lydia kind of keeps drawing comparisons to a young Tiger Woods. With her 11th career win on the tour, coming in her 71st start, at the age of 18 years and 11 months and 3 days, it compares to Tiger's 11th career win in his 67th start and when he was 23 years old. So Lydia's doing it 5 years sooner. Plus, she won a couple tournaments as an amateur on the tour that Tiger never did. A couple more things from the Kia Classic. Minji Lee made an albatross at a par 4. It was only the second hole-in-one on a par 4 in LPGA Tour history when her tee shot at the par 4 16th hole found the bottom of the cup on Saturday. And Carlos, all 7 events thus far on the LPGA Tour have been won by women under the age of 23. Lexi Thompson is the only non-Asian-born player to win on the LPGA Tour in 2016. As you know, Ko is technically a Kiwi from New Zealand, but was born in Korea, and her parents moved to New Zealand when Ko was just 5 years old. So, Carlos, we got a major this week. We're pretty excited about that.
First major of the year, and looking forward to see what Lydia Ko is going to bring there. We're going to take our first short break, and when we come back, we have the Par 5 News presented by United Golf Network, so don't go anywhere.
Thank you for listening. We'll be right back. In the meantime, don't forget to visit www.edraft.com for analysis, breaking news, and more. Also, remember to follow us on Twitter at edraftsports and on Facebook at facebook.com/edraftsports. Now, back to the show.
And we're back, and now it's time for the Par 5 News presented by United Golf Network. Fred, today we're going to have our practice range talking about Tim Finchem's legacy as a PGA Tour commissioner, and that is because of the tee shot news that you're going to be talking about. Is that he's stepping down by the end of this season, so what's going on there with the PGA Tour commissioner?
Yeah, there's just so much to talk about there, Carlos. PGA Tour Commissioner Tim Finchem announced over the weekend in Austin that he was granted a one-year extension to his contract and will step down prior to 2017. Jay Monahan was named the chief operating officer last week and is basically in control of the day-to-day operations of the tour as of now. We're going to discuss Finchem's long list of accomplishments a little bit later, but let me just go into a few things here. Finchem succeeded Dean Beaman, who had been the Tour's commissioner for 20 years. This will be Finchem's 23rd and last year in office. Under his guidance, the Tour has seen tremendous growth in purses, TV exposure, and the number of events. He has also been instrumental in the formation of the International Federation of Golf and the World Golf Foundation. His personal dedication to the success of the World Golf Foundation's The First Tee initiative has meant that in more than 10 years, The First Tee has grown to include more than 200 chapters and reaches more than 6.5 million young people. The President's Cup, the FedEx Cup, the wraparound schedule have all been added under the watchful eye of Tim Finchem. He also oversaw the expansion of the tour to Latino America, Canada, China, and the growth of the Web.com Tour and the Web.com Tour Final Series. Carlos, I know you like numbers, so I've got a few for you. In 1993, the year prior to Tim Finchem becoming commissioner, the PGA Tour had 43 events, which totaled $53 million in prize money. The average first-place check was a little over $200,000 a week. In 2016, this year, the final year of Finchem's commissionership, The seven wraparound events in the fall paid out $44 million alone in prize money, plus the 38 tournaments totaling another $252 million, bringing that grand total with the wraparound and the regular season to $296 million in total prize money this year. Plus, the average first-place check is a little north of $1 million. We're talking some serious money here, Carlos. But wait, there's more, just like on TV. Thanks to the generous folks at the FedEx, they add another $34 million in prize money for the four playoff events and $35 million of bonus pool available to the top 150 players at the end of the season. That brings our grand total, ding, 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 to $365 million paid out in 49 events available to the 200 or so touring pros on the PGA Tour this year. Who says golf is dying, Carlos? And we're going to elaborate a little bit more later in the show. But believe it, this is not the best thing that Tim Fincham has done for the PGA Tour. There's something way more important than that. The Tour was a strong, vibrant entity when he assumed leadership, and he's going to leave it even better than when he began his tenure, Carlos.
Oh, he does, and we have more to talk about, so just leave it there. Otherwise, we're going to have said everything. Hey, you know, before he was a world-famous PGA Tour champion, Jordan Spieth was a standout golfer for the Texas Longhorns, and he still carries that Austin pride with him, judging by his choice of delicacy for the Masters Champions Dinner. You know, Ben Crenshaw, a two-time champion who leads the conversation at the dinner, said last Monday that Jordan Spieth had chosen Salt Lake Barbecue to be served. Crenshaw called it a great choice from right here in Austin, Texas. Unfortunately, Spieth corrected that story on Tuesday, but the barbecue will be from the Lone Star State. Spieth said on Tuesday, and I quote, "I didn't select Salt Lake. I don't know where that was spread from. Augusta National always makes the meals. So they ask, what do you want to have for your meal? And I said, I'd love to do some Texas barbecue. So they kind of go out and search for a way to make it based on popular places. I'm not sure what it's exactly going to be. It's going to be Texas barbecue. I'm pretty excited for it." End of quote. Maybe they asked Crenshaw, I don't know, who hosted his first of two dinners in 1985 for a tip of a good Texas barbecue, and then he referred, you know, hey, Salt Lake. I don't know. That's just me trying to lobby for that one as well. I mean, which, given Spieth's tenure in Austin, the pick makes sense, although to me, Franklin barbecue might make a tastier sense. Okay, I'm getting hungry, so let's just state that. But anyway, the Champions Dinner dates back more than 60 years. It's a meal served to the former Masters champions at Augusta National Golf Club, with the fare chosen by the past year's winner. According to Austin360.com, Dallas native Ben Hogan began that tradition. The selections are always interesting insight into a player's lives. And take a look at Goofy Bubba Watson served Caesar salad, grilled chicken, and macaroni and cheese in 2013, likely with a side of warm milk, leading to that acerbic Nick Faldo to drop his brilliant tweet on him. While the gutsy and personable Phil Mickelson had served lobster ravioli in 2005 and paella on 2011. You know, they range from simple cheeseburgers and milkshakes like Tiger Woods did in 1998 to sophisticated seafood, tomka, chicken panang curry, baked sea scallops with garlic sauce, rack of lamb with yellow curry sauce, baked fillet chili and sea bass with three-flavor chili sauce and liche sorbet. That was just one, Vijay Singh in 2001. Fred, I'm getting hungry. What would you pick as your Masters dinner?
I like cheeseburgers, and I like meatloaf, and I like steak, and I like spaghetti, and I like lasagna. And Carlos, it would be tough to choose. I like them all.
Hey, I like all those ideas that you gave. I like them.
Maybe we'd had just one of each, you know, a little choice or something, a little buffet.
Hey, look at what Vijay Singh had. I mean, six different courses. So.
There you go. Well, he's a big guy. He can put it down.
Yeah.
Hey, Carlos, speaking of the Masters, Bryson DeChambeau, the U.S. amateur winner and the NCAA golf champion last year, is taking winning the Masters as an amateur pretty seriously. He has even met with CBS announcer Jim Nantz to get additional insight into Augusta National. DeChambeau will be making his final start as an amateur at the Masters next week. Nantz feels DeChambeau has the capacity to utterly change golf, and that a win by the amateur would be a fulfillment of Bobby Jones' dream of glory going to the amateur. Casey Reamer, the head pro at Cypress Point and a mentor to Bryson, asked Nantz if he would speak to DeChambeau about the history of the Masters. The two chatted for 2 hours. DeChambeau asked every question imaginable about every significant player in Masters history, with an emphasis on tales of amateurs such as Billy Joe Patton, Frank Stranahan. Frank Stranahan, by the way, Carlos, didn't know if you knew this or not, but was from Toledo, Ohio. Ken Venturi and Charlie Coe. Nantz even gave Bryson DVDs of all the recent Masters, not for entertainment, but to study hole locations, how putts break, where players were laying up on the par fives. This young guy is obsessed with winning the Masters as an amateur. His mind works in a unique scientific way. It all reminded Nantz of Bert Yancey and how he constructed clay models of the greens at Augusta and studied them. It wouldn't surprise Nantz at all to see DeChambeau contend. The RBC Heritage, which is traditionally held the week after the Masters, offered DeChambeau a sponsor's invitation, and he will use it to play his first event as a professional. DeChambeau, after being informed by the NCAA that he could not defend his NC2A championship due to suspension of SMU for recruiting infractions before DeChambeau's time there, has been playing professional events around the world to prepare for the Masters and his pro debut. And he's been playing pretty well, Carlos. He's been making cuts, and looks like he's been having a pretty good time at it. I follow him on Facebook, and he has posts on there quite often.
Oh, and if any amateur can win, he can win. He has the poise, he has the knowledge, and he's great. I think he's going to be a very good pro. So, that's another player to keep an eye on the Masters next week. Hey, it's a 795-acre parcel that was part of the now-defunct Cliffs at High Carolina development and that was slated to be the first Tiger Woods design golf course is up for sale. The price is listed at a measly $24 million. In addition to its star-studded past, the land is significant because it's a large, contiguous parcel in Buncombe County. It's about 25 minutes drive from downtown Asheville and Fairview. Such parcels are becoming harder to find as Asheville grows, said Drew Reisinger, Buncombe County Register of Deeds. The Cliffs at High Carolina was eviscerated by the collapse of the real estate market and perhaps the decline of Wood star power on and off the course. The development was about to feature 1,000 luxury homes and the first Woods designed American golf course, according to a 2007 announcement. For many years, Woods was literally the face of the development. His likeness appeared at an area of billboards advertising the Pine Community's amenities. But, as you might remember, that 2010 infidelity scandal tarnished his image, and as you can expect, everything went literally south. By May 2011, South Carolina-based developer Jim Anthony declared sales were too slow to continue pushing the development. He said fewer than 50 of the more than 1,000 home sites available at prices that started at $500,000 had been sold in the previous 42 months. Less than a year later, foreclosure procedures began at several of the developments held by the Cliffs communities, which owned the Cliffs at High Carolina, as well as the Cliffs at Walnut Cove in Arden. There were efforts to revive the properties through bankruptcy, restructuring, new developer companies, but there was to no avail. Fred, the real estate company is marketing that land under a trademark name, the Majestic Highlands of Asheville. The listing calls it a trophy property. I don't know, maybe Tiger, who definitely would love to add another trophy to his case, can buy this one.
Carlos, I have been to the Asheville area on many, many occasions. Used to go there with a group on a golf outing, buddy's trip every year, and just love that area. It's absolutely gorgeous. Real nice golf course there that we've played. It's too bad that went down. That just didn't work out for Tiger at all. Hey, Carlos, here's a kind of a cool little story I found. Famous actor Bill Murray's son, Luke Murray, is an assistant basketball coach for Xavier, who got bounced out of the NCAA tournament in the second round by Wisconsin. He was speaking with an interviewer from ESPN when he was asked for his favorite line from the movie. He answered, "I've never seen it. I've heard it's good, but I've never seen it." Isn't that un-American or something? I mean, isn't there a law? I mean, when you're young, and I mean, you got your dad's got to watch. You got to watch this movie with your dad. I mean, what's the deal with that? So never saw the movie, you know, starring his own father as Carl the Greenskeeper. I mean, that was an Academy performance. Plus Luke's uncle, Brian Doyle Murray, co-wrote it and played the role of the caddy master in the film. So it's a family affair. You got to watch Uncle and Dad in this movie. Never saw it. Evidently, Luke Murray is a gym rat and not a golfer. And Carlos, that's just not right. I'm protesting that. I may never watch Xavier basketball again. And Carlos, that wraps up the Par 5 News presented by United Golf Network, who wants every golfer to enjoy the game more and have the opportunity to earn money while doing it. They offer a top line of golf products, including popular name brands like Wilson, Greg Norman, Ashworth, TaylorMade, Adidas, and Where to Win. Everything a golfer needs, clubs, balls, bags, shoes, apparel, and accessories, are available with discount coupons for huge savings. You get 10% off as a director, and you get another 17% off. I mean, it's a pretty good deal, Carlos. If guys haven't checked this out, they need to go there. They not only have an excellent product line, they also offer every golf nut the chance to earn commissions on product through their director's program. It helps you set up your own pro shop. You don't have to go and pay the exorbitant price that you do for all your golf equipment. So go to UnitedGolfNetwork.com today. Check out the products, discounts, and their opportunity, Carlos.
And that will wrap up our Par 5 News presented by United Golf Network. We're going to take our second short break, and when we come back, we have the VIG, very important guest of the week section. Don't go anywhere.
Thank you for listening to the Back Nine Report presented by eDraft.com. We'll be right back. Don't forget to check out our co-hosts on Twitter by clicking their names in the episode description. Now, back to the show.
And we're back, and now it's time for our VIG, very important guest of the week. Is golf course designer Mike DeVries, who will talk about his new transatlantic partnership with Frank Pond and his new course in Tasmania, just off the coast of Melbourne, Australia. So, Fred, tell us a little bit more if you want to add up to set up this interview.
Yeah, this is the second time we've had Mike on the show. The last time he was working on a project up in New York State. He does a lot of renovation work. He's also built some new constructions. He has three real nice golf courses, public golf courses around Grand Rapids, Michigan. He built Kingsley Club up south of Traverse City, which is one of my favorite golf courses anywhere. It's wonderful. I love it. Gray Walls up in the UP of Michigan is one of the top-ranked on Golf Digest lists of good public, of great golf, public golf courses in the U.S. I'm going to try and get there this summer. But he built this course down in he got the gig to build a course in Tasmania, which, as you mentioned, is off the coast of Melbourne on an island in the channel between Tasmania and Melbourne. And he even moved his family, as he says, he moved his family down there for 6 months. So So he announced this thing about the partnership with Frank Pont. So I chatted him up and said, hey, let's talk about it a little bit. So I had a nice chat with him. Matter of fact, the interview was much longer than what you're going to hear tonight. I had to cut a bunch of stuff out because we were just talking away. So go ahead and run it, Carlos.
That's right.
We are talking with Mike DeVries from DeVries Golf Course Design. Mike has just entered into a new transatlantic partnership with Frank Pond, who's based in the Netherlands. Mike, welcome to the show. This is a big announcement for you.
Yeah, it is. Thanks for having me on the show. I appreciate it, and it is. It's a wonderful venture. I'm looking very much forward to it, and so is Frank.
Done some great work here in the U.S., most notably your work up at Gray Walls in the UP of Upper Michigan, the Kingsley Club, which is, I think, up to number 19 on Golf Digest list of top 100 in the United States. Cape Wickham is getting a lot of talk and a lot of play. Tell us a little bit about that golf course. Where is that located?
It's in Australia. It's on King Island, and King Island is a part of the state of Tasmania, which is, they call it the island state over there. So if you think about geographically, you have Melbourne in the state of Victoria in the southeast corner of Australia, and Tasmania is below that. And in between Melbourne and Tasmania is the Bass Strait, which is one of the most challenging sailing areas in the world. And right smack dab in the middle of that is King Island. It's an island of about 30 by 60 kilometers. And at the very north tip of that is Cape Wickham, and there's a lighthouse there that was built in 1861 to signal this landform and the shoals that are out there, because there were a lot of shipwrecks back in the 1800s around King Island, and that ended up being something that was built, and there was a life-saving station there, et cetera, and the golf course is actually right next to it, within 100, 150 yards of the lighthouse.
I was looking at some of the pictures on the website, and it really looks like something that you would see in Scotland, that type of a links-type course. Obviously, you have a lot of wind comes into play there.
A pure links golf course. The thing that's really interesting, you know, it's all sand with some sandy sandstone outcroppings here and there, but it's different from other places. Like, typically, if you're at St. Andrews, it's all very, you know, level, rolling dunes, smaller undulations and things like constantly moving. And then you have other courses, for instance, like Bandon Dunes or Pebble Beach, which are all cliffs, which are all, you know, rock faces. Now, whether they're technically pure links versus, say, you know, some of the Scottish courses, but seaside courses, they're comparatively similar in a lot of ways. What's unique about Cape Wickham is that we have a sandy cove beach that looks like the Blue Lagoon, where the 18th hole comes up right below the clubhouse. So this beautiful north-facing, so sun-receiving because it's the southern hemisphere. And we have cliffs. The first hole, there's a big cliff off to the right of the hole, 50 or 60 feet. And we have other holes that are right at the level of the water, tees that are on rocks with waves washing next to them. So you interact with the water in a lot of different ways here, not just with the same geographical formation or type. And you come at it from a lot of different angles. It's not a straight coastline. There's a cove, there's a headland, there's some straight rocks down there. And so it's a really diverse environment that you're dealing with as far as how you relate with the water and how you, you know, socially interact with it as a golfer.
It's a pretty good hike from Traverse City, Michigan to Tasmania. How did you get involved in that project to begin with?
Darius Oliver is an Australian writer, introduced me to the project, and I went over on sort of a scouting mission to try and help them figure some things out, hit it off, and I'd known Darius for, you know, a while, and he was involved trying to get some investors and, you know, sort of the organizational aspect of it together. He was providing some advice. It just worked out really well, and they liked, you know, the concepts that I came up with. And Duncan Andrews, who's the owner, paired up. Darius kind of, you know, introduced him to it also. And there was another gentleman, Andrew Purchase, who found the land and has a golf construction company. So it was a really big team effort. And, you know, Duncan's doing a great job getting everything going, and it's really been quite fantastic. And so it's a long ways but it's that good that, you know, I went there and brought my family over there for 6 months, and it was a fantastic experience, not only just building the golf course, but, you know, it's from a family standpoint and that kind of thing.
Expanding on this, that was kind of really your first major project outside the United States. Now you're pairing up with Frank Pond, who is Infinite Variety Golf Design, and he's based out of the Netherlands. He's kind of an expert with Harry Cult Design, and I know your background is very deep with McAllister and Roth and Seth Rayner and Tillinghast. What do you expect to see out of it?
Well, it's exciting from that standpoint that Frank's, all his work is kind of based in Europe and in the UK. You know, I've traveled around the world doing various projects and things like that. So it's an interesting marriage because he's done a lot of really high quality, particularly with Colt, Allison, Tom Simpson golf courses. He's done a lot of work with restoration and those old classics. Likewise, I've done a lot of that stuff with Mackenzie's work and Ross and Rayner's and some of the old guys here that are more prevalent in the States. From that aspect, have sort of understandings of the, you know, various designers that are a little bit different than each other, and we're doing good work with clubs that way. I've got more new build experience and obviously with Kate Wickham and Kingsley and Graywall, things that have been really, really well received, you know, nationally and internationally. And so there's an opportunity to develop new courses for clients in Europe and the UK, as well as to bring Frank's sort of expertise with Colton Allison, Simpson courses over here to the States. It's a way of us being both, you know, small individual practitioners, of us to kind of expand our realm and have an ability to go to other areas with someone that's familiar with that section, and to be able to have a partner to kind of work on that. It won't be that we'll work on everything together, but it's a very exciting opportunity to have that chance to do that.
With your background and with what you've done here in the U.S., when you're working outside the country like you were there in Tasmania, what's the biggest difference that you see when you're working on something like that away from home?
Certainly, there's differences in expectations of golf. In the States, the layperson generally thinks of a golf course as all green, really well manicured. It's a beautiful park, right? Everything's perfect. Some of that happens, you know, we got the Masters coming up, and, you know, everybody sees that. That's the start of spring in the north here for everybody that's coming out of the winter. Augusta is perfect. I mean, there isn't a blade of grass out of place there when they have the tournament. But that the rest of the world doesn't necessarily look at that. I mean, it's a very fundamental game for the average guy in the UK, in Australia, in other parts of the world where it's not as expensive to build, play, or participate in the sport. And it's a little bit more of a cultural thing with how people play or experience the game. That's a different aspect, and that's kind of refreshing, actually, because it's more about the golf and the camaraderie, and it's not about perfect conditions and what we see on the PGA Tour every week, where they've been prepping that golf course for months or a year ahead of time to get prepared for one individual event. It's more about how the average guy plays the golf course on a daily or weekly basis.
That kind of leads us into the next question. You're kind of put into the school of the minimalist design, and some of the more modern golf course designers like Coore Crenshaw, Gil Hance, Tom Doak, maybe David McClay Kidd, from what you're saying there, we don't need to have the most fancy golf club in the world, most manicured. We can go out there and make a nice golf course for people to play and not spend $20 million and still have a really fine facility.
You can have a really well-designed, fun golf course that doesn't have, maybe it's walk-in only, you know, Bandon Dunes. They have a couple of golf carts there in case you're infirmed and, you know, need something. But everybody walks there, and that's what they do. You know, the majority of people walk in the UK when they play the game. If you can accommodate that, then you don't have to build a bunch of cart paths. You don't have to think about how that cart traffic negatively impacts turf quality. You're also thinking about the transition of the golfer as he goes from this tee to the fairway to the green, and then from that green to the next tee. We lose track of that sometimes when we're building golf in a, you know, in a big development. Well, you know, I can just drive a quarter of a mile, and I can start another hole over here because we can put 10 houses in between here and there. And that's fine, and there's a spot for that. But I think myself, as well as the guys you just mentioned, you know, we want to think about the golf experience and how can we do that and then accomplish maybe the other aspects of a development, whether that's housing, whether that's the membership or other things that they have as far as what they want to accomplish with that, other facilities. So there's a number of ways to do that. And, you know, Mike Gil Hance and I, we worked with, you know, with Tom Doak 25 years ago, Bill Coor and Tom Doak, they worked for Pete Dye, and he's sort of the patriarch of, you know, being in the dirt and building things. So we're sort of taking that and we're applying that to a lot of the classic designs and trying to work with the land and build things where golf for us is number one. We're obviously thinking about what other clients' demands are, but we're trying to build a great golf experience for people.
I know you kind of cut your teeth. You spent a lot of time around Crystal Downs growing up. Do you see that influence in a lot of the stuff that you're working at? And when you go, do you when you get done, you say, "Oh yeah, I you know that's the same kind of thing that we have there at Crystal Downs."
Well, it's a huge influence for me. I grew up working on the golf course there and playing. I'm a member now. I'm out there regularly in the summer when I get back home. The place is just really amazing, and I see little nuances and things every time I'm on the property. So it's that good, and it does influence me. I don't think you don't necessarily take something and try and build it exactly, but you use the principles of what was there, in at least the way that I do it. You know, Seth Rayner and C.B. McDonald, they had a template of holes where they built a Redan hole on every golf course and a Biarritz and a road hole and those types of things. I look at it, those principles are really strong, but we're not necessarily trying to build the exact same arsenal of holes with every golf course. It's fun to discover and try and do something that's a little different or apply that to a unique piece of property. And every golf course is different because the property is different. It's not like a tennis court. I mean, it's a flat and it's X by X or a basketball court. And so that's one of the fun and exciting things about the job.
Well, Mike, thanks a lot for talking to us today. We wish you a lot of luck and success with your new partnership with Infinite Variety Golf out of the Netherlands, Frank Pott. We hear great things about Cape Wickham, and I know from I haven't been to Graywalls either. I tend to get up there this summer sometime also. I was up there last summer, but we didn't have time to get over there. I know you're doing great work, and good luck to you.
Well, thanks very much. I appreciate being on the show. And, next you got to get to Graywalls because it's fantastic, an unbelievable place, very, very unique, great people, and a lot of fun. The views are phenomenal there. So it's definitely worth it. It's not that far, really. It seems like it's forever, but the UP is so inviting. It's a great place to go.
If you want to see more from Mike DeVries, you can visit his website, DeVries, D-E-V-R-I-E-S, designs.com. Check out his website, the course he's worked on. He does a wonderful job. If you get up to Michigan, check out Kingsley Club. Get up into UP to Gray Walls. You will not be disappointed. Thanks again, Mike.
Thanks for having me. Have a great day. Cheers.
There you have it. That was golf designer Mike DeVries and Fred. I think he's going to be busy for the next few years, and we're going to start to get to know him more, and as people is also going to start to get him to know more about his great work.
Yeah, he's definitely on the rise. He came on the radar with when Graywalls opened and Kingsley Club, too. They are just such great golf courses. If you ever get a chance to see them, they are simply beautiful. And last year, when Matt Janella had the Course Designers Week, you know, on Golf Channel, Mike was one of the guys that came in for that. And I was not familiar with him up until then, actually. And then when I found out he was from Michigan, I made it a point to meet him and got to meet him last year at Crystal Downs, actually. and got to play Kingsley Club last year. So, I found out more about him last year and got to know him a little bit. So, we'll keep in touch with him. As he mentioned, he and Core and Doak enhance what they build are more realistic golf courses, not the real fancy show places like, let's say, Muirfield Village is, or a TPC Sawgrass. That's not really what he does. When he gets done with a golf course, you think more of it coming out of the early 1900s. There's another course being going to open up this summer in Michigan, Forest Dunes, that we're going to be talking more about as we go through the summer here. For example, that golf course is going to be reversible. It's a Tom Doak design, and it's not going to have tee boxes. The tees, the fairways, the roughs, they're all mowed the same. The only thing that's any different are the greens. One day they'll just throw the markers out there and say, okay, here's where the tees are today. Not in this fancy mowing stuff. Just, here it is, go play. So that's where they get the name the minimalist school of golf design. Keep it simple, stupid. They do a great job. We're going to hear more from them down the road, Carlos.
Well, that's our VIG Very Important Guest of the Week, golf cart designer Mike DeVries. We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we have the practice range where we will talk about Tim Finchin's legacy as PGA Tour Commissioner. Don't go away.
Thank you for listening. We'll be right back. In the meantime, don't forget to visit www.edraft.com for analysis, breaking news, and more. Also, remember to follow us on Twitter at edraftsports and on Facebook at facebook.com/edraftsports. Don't forget to check out our co-hosts on Twitter by clicking their names in the episode description. Now, back to the show.
And we're back, and now it's time for our practice range. Every week, we pick a topic, Frickin' and I, and each of us take our tee shot at it. And this week, we have to talk about, our tee shot today on the Par 5 News presented by United Golf Network, taken by Fred, was about PGA Tour Commissioner Tim Finchin stepping down from his position at the end of the year. We'll be talking about his legacy and what we can expect from his apparent successor at PGA Tour, the Deputy Commissioner, Jay Monahan. I mean, Tim Finchin, who once was an economic advisor during the Jimmy Carter's presidency at the Tour, has served in various roles prior to succeeding Dean Beeman as Commissioner, including Deputy Commissioner, Vice President of Business Affairs, and Chief Operating Officer. He was appointed PGA Tour Commissioner in 1994, just when Tiger Woods was about to start college and Greg Norman was number one in the world. He has also been in charge during a time of tremendous growth, presiding over huge television rights deals that have seen prices skyrocket. I mean, like Fred already mentioned all those numbers, but I'm just going to go over a few of them. Finchin, when he took over, the total purses were approximately $56 million, a number that grew to $256 million by 2006, and he's well in excess of $300 million this year. He negotiated the first of three TV contracts shortly after Tiger Woods won his first major at 1987 Masters, and prize money since there has soared. He also used Woods' popularity to launch the first tee with hopes of broadening golf's appeal to youth. The latest TV contracts for the PGA Tour were 10-year deals with CBS Sports and NBC Sports so that they would be concurrent with the 15-year deal the Tour previously signed with Golf Channel. All TV deals expire in 2021. Finchin said the Tour might start this year working on the next extension, especially with more digital platforms available. And that brings me to his apparent successor, which is PGA Tour Commissioner and now COO, Jay Monahan. Finchin said that the affable Monahan has already assumed most day-to-day operational duties while also strengthening the ties with the sponsors. And that is very important for a transition plan to be in place, definitely. But more surprising than that was Finch's admission that he believes the time has come for new energy, something Monahan, who's only 43 years of age, figures to bring in the same way that Adam Silver and Rob Manfred has delivered already to the NBA and MLB after recently succeeding longtime commissioners David Stern and Bob Cilic. However, I see two big challenges right off the bat for him, and the first will definitely require a lot of energy that he must bring. First, I will have to point out that Finchum has questioned the need for the European Tour at all by insisting that professional golf should be controlled by one global organization. He cited commercial reasons as the logic behind his stance. You know, his being at odds with Keith Pelley, the arrival of him as the chief executive of the European Tour, has seen a series already of statements about boosting tournament status and prize funds. The aim is clear. There's no denying about it. It's to provide leading players with a realistic alternative to the riches available in the United States. And Finchum definitely sees that as a threat. Or at least, if he doesn't see it that way, he's making it look like it does. And second, it has to be the Donald Trump factor and his big exit from the business. Finchum has said at the beginning of this month that there exists a good relationship from the tour with Donald Trump, but that is despite the fact that the two sides may not do business beyond 2016. And we have already said, you know, it's a big loss. All that money that Donald Trump is pouring into golf, he's one of the biggest investors, if not the biggest investor right now in golf in the whole world. So if that money, those investments are not, those businesses are here, you know that the European Tour and Keith Pelley might like to do really that. So that's the second one that I see. So, Fred, with Finchum staying on through at least the end of the season, Monahan has the time to get accustomed to the position and develop a plan for the PGA Tour going forward. But he'll have some big shoes to fill and big challenges ahead.
Well, certainly, Carlos, you know, Tim Finchum is certainly not going to be remembered for his bubbly and outgoing personality. But he has been the nearly perfect man for the job at the PGA Tour since 1994. His calm, quiet demeanor makes him credible and thoughtful, which I'm sure plays very well in the boardrooms of corporate America as well as the PGA Tour offices in Florida. You know, he succeeded Dean Beaman, who probably does not get near the credit for the job that he did running the PGA Tour in the 70s and 80s. And Finchum continued to build on Beaman's success and just keep adding to it. He was a little lucky that Tiger Woods decided to turn professional in 1996, just 2 years after Finchum took office. But it takes a smart manager to get the best from his product, and Finchum did just that, turning Woods' presence on tour into a multi-million-dollar contract with television, bringing Fortune 500 companies into the game as sponsors and adding more events for younger players to have more shots at keeping their cards. Make no mistake, the fall wraparound schedule was all about more sponsorship dollars for the tour. But it also allows more opportunities for tour players to add events toward the requirement for the lucrative pension fund that the PGA Tour offers its members. We mentioned the President's Cup started under Finchum's tenure. It has been a huge financial windfall for the tour. The FedEx Cup playoffs began in 2007. FedEx alone added $35 million to the additional bonus pool. Now, we come to the really most important thing. You know, I talked earlier about Finchum's most important contribution. And all this other stuff is great, all the things he's done. It's just phenomenal when you look back on it. But make no mistake, when you ask tour players what the single most important contribution Tim Finchum made to the PGA Tour, their answer will be the formula for funding the pension fund. It is a performance-based calculation that rewards the number of cuts a player makes over his career. A player starting on tour today and experiencing a 10-year career could end his tour days with over $42 million in his retirement account and never win an event. Tiger Woods' retirement account is estimated to be worth over $300 million at his age 60. And David Duval, $100 million. Those kind of numbers get your attention pretty quickly, Carlos. So when you see guys fighting to make the cut on Friday afternoon, it's just not to make a check that week. It's to add another week of pension contribution for their retirement fund, which is a lot more than anything they would make that week. So Tim Finchem has been a phenomenal commissioner for PGA Tour Golf. Growth in purses, growth in prize money, growth in sponsorship, growth in charitable dollars going out, over $1 billion just during his 22 years alone. Those are all phenomenal things. But the tour today, a player coming on to tour today, if he can have a 5 or 7 or 8 year career, he doesn't have to win a tournament, he just has to make some cuts. He can have a nice retirement at the age of 55 or 60. So that's a big, big deal. Now, for the new guy, well, I really don't know much about him. I've read just a little bit about it. He was a four-year member of the golf team at Trinity College. He was a Division II academic All-American in his senior year. He earned a master's degree in sports management from the University of Massachusetts in Amherst. So he's served as several different jobs within the PGA Tour. He was the executive director of the Players' Championship. He worked for Fenway Sports Group. So he's got experience, and evidently he is a great manager, a great bureaucrat in that kind of a system. The points that you brought up, I think, are very interesting about the challenges he faces. And the one that I think is going to turn out to be one of the biggest for them is the digital piece. How are they going to broadcast? Are they going to go with network television? Are they going to do their own broadcast through digital platforms and then let the networks fight for it or air it if they pay a fee for it? That has unbelievable potential, Carlos. And they've been playing with that now for a couple years. So they're, you know, a couple more years, they're going to get pretty good at it. And the contracts don't expire until 2021. Now, they want to have something in place well before that. But there's a lot of things in play here. The European Tour keeps coming up more and more. How's that going to play out? It's going to be an interesting watch. You and I watch that all the time. We talk about it from time to time here in the show. But it comes down to the biggest factor is keeping those sponsors happy and making sure that you can fund those $6, $7, and $10 million purses so those guys have something to come and play for, Carlos. So Tim Finchem leaves a phenomenal legacy to professional golf. Monahan has some big shoes to fill. Only two commissioners over the last 43 years. Seen tremendous growth in the tour in those years. You know, taking it from the Arnold Palmer years, the Jack Nicklaus years, up to the Tiger Woods years. Unbelievable growth. So if this guy can do half as much as what those two guys did, it'll be amazing to me, Carlos.
And the jury's still out. But like you mentioned, I don't know either much about him. I think we'll start to know more about him now as media might start inquiring him. Now that Finchem said that he's on the day-to-day operation. So we'll see. We'll see. But there's definitely some challenges, and especially that one as well. It's a big one. Finchem said that they want to start next year working with it, and I believe that's something that he might be moving Monahan to do so. But Tim Finchem, definitely, wow, what a legacy. I mean, his work is incredible. He might not win popularity contest, but hey, he got the job done, and a great one. Let's move on now to our final putts, and I'm going to start right away talking about, you know, Detroit Golf Club's executive informed members Friday that an Under the Lights June exhibition involving tour stars Rory McIlroy and Ricky Fowler, which had been targeted for June 7th, was canceled when negotiations between the event sponsors Quicken Loans and the participants failed to reach a deal. DGC apparently became victim of high-end bargaining beyond its control. Their officials and members had wanted desperately to seal a tour deal, but were not involved in the negotiations. This is meaning that Southeast Michigan's tours golf drought continues. The Buick Open in Grand Blanc ceased operations in 2009, and that was the last PGA Tour event in Michigan. Another piece of news, and this one's sad. Luke Donald, he will miss the Masters for the first time since 2004. Even if he would have won the Puerto Rico Open this past weekend, he would have not qualified since this one is considered an alternate event to this week's WGC Dell Match Play. This extends a troubling trend for Donald, who had to qualify for last year's U.S. Open for the first time in 11 years after falling to 66 in the world. And in 9 events this season, he has just 1 top 25 finish. And if you have noticed that Ryo Ishikawa has not been on the PGA Tour leaderboards lately, well, he's been out indefinitely with a back injury. He pulled out of the Pebble Beach Pro-Am complaining of lower back pain and was aiming to return in early March, but the 24-year-old said he needs to reinvent his swing to take the pressure off his back before rejoining the PGA Tour. At least he will be having a good time. I mean, he recently got married, so congratulations to him on that part. And finally, Fred, another one who will be out indefinitely, Nick Watney, who will take the rest of the year off to help heal a herniated disc in his lower back. So to avoid turning it into a chronic thing that will flare up every few years, he will give it a time to rest and will give it enough time.
Hey, Carlos, if you want to watch something cool on Sunday morning, if you don't go to church and you're slipping around the channels there, the drive, chip, and putt finals from Augusta National will be on the Golf Channel on Sunday morning. 4 different age groups for both boys and girls, 7 to 9, 10 to 11, 12 to 13, and 14 to 15, will compete for the championship of the drive, chip, and putt. This is really cool, Carlos. These kids qualify from all over the U.S., get invited to Augusta National along with their parents to compete in their age group. The coverage will start on Golf Channel at 8 a.m. on Sunday with a pregame show, and the finals, the actual competition, will begin at 9. Rich Lerner and Peter Jacobson are going to handle the broadcast duties. John Daly made the headlines. One of his claret jugs is up for sale on Green Jacket Auctions, with the auction set to close April 9th, right before the final round of the Masters. Open Championship winners are allowed to keep the official claret jug for just a year after their victory, and they're allowed to buy what are casually called players' jugs. They're slightly smaller versions of the real thing, and Daly apparently had a couple of these and recently let one go. On Twitter, he said he thought it was going to be donated to a museum, but evidently the person conned him and is selling it. So if you want to bid on that, Carlos, the bidding has started at $5,000. It's already up over $8,000, so you better get your bid in. You've only got another week or so to do it. And news out of China, the government closed another golf course, this time one that had done everything by the book. Orient Shanghai, the longtime host venue of the Shanghai Classic on the China LPGA Tour, before the golf course was there, there were fish farms that occupied the site. They were prone to flooding in the rainy season. It's alongside the river there. While club officials declined to talk about the matter, the reason for its closing is that the Hangpu is Shanghai's source of drinking water, and golf is seen as a pollutant. The government wants to see farming on the land that the course occupied. Yeah, you know, rice farming doesn't put any pollutants back in the river. According to an environmental study conducted by the club, local farmers use 20 to 30 times more fertilizers and pesticides than the golf course did. So kind of a surprise move. The Chinese government closed the golf course that had been operating for some time, had gone through all the Environmental Protection Agency process, got all the permits they needed, did it all right. There was no grass or anything involved, and they still closed it. So can you imagine our political leaders trying to deal with these people in China on anything? I mean, they change their minds in a heartbeat. You know, how do you deal with these people? Carlos, that's all I have for tonight. I'm off tomorrow. I'm taking off for Pinehurst. Carlos, think of me. I'm going to be playing Pinehurst and Kiwa over the next week.
Oh, you're going to have such a hard time. I know. You have to get some of those sacrifices to go in. But no.
Taking another one for the team, Carlos. I do anything for the show. I'm just going down research. I'm working all the time.
I know. Heaven is granted for you. Don't worry. Hey, Back Niners, that wraps up another week of the Back Nine Report presented by eDraft.com. Thank you for listening. It's always our pleasure to bring you the latest on the world of golf. Special thanks to our VIG, very important guest of the week, golf course designer Mike DeVries. Don't forget to join us and again next Tuesday at 8 p.m. Eastern Time here on Blog Talk Radio, or if you missed it, check it out on iTunes or tune in. And if you haven't done so, follow the show. Our Twitter ID is at Pac9Report with the number 9 in the middle. My name is Carlos Torres, along with Fred Alvader. We wish you to be happy, be blessed, and enjoy the great game of golf. Happy golfing, everybody.
Good night, everybody.